This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. It now seems certain that our planet will undergo rapid and substantial climate change near enough in the future that the very next generation will have to confront massive disruptions and expenses. Due to time lag factors in the modes of causation, it is far too late to prevent climate change from being both fast and vast. It is not quite too late to mitigate it somewhat, and it is certainly not too late to prepare for it. I'm reading from a paper, as yet unpublished, written by Colin Duncan, who teaches environmental history and modern British history at Queen's University and McGill University in Canada. In this paper, Duncan predicts the collapse of 20th century civilization and the importance of planning for a necessary transition to a new society not based on the burning of fossil fuels. Joining us now by phone from Kingston, Ontario, Canada, is Colin Duncan. Welcome to you.
Hello, thank you. Welcome. Glad to be here.
Oh, well, glad to have you with us. You have been studying environment and society for many years. When did you first realize that climate change was a crisis of the most urgent kind?
It slowly dawned on me over a period of several months, only a couple of years ago. I was involved with climate change specialists in work in helping setting up schools and environment going back 15 years. And I read various things, but I didn't really become worried about the change being so soon and large until just a couple of years ago. And at first I was rather stunned, surprised, and ashamed. And then I began to realize I had to start working on the topic.
Well, part of this paper is about what may have caused many people, including you, to underestimate climate change as a crisis over the past few decades. What is one example of something that made people not realize, despite perhaps certain evidence, that climate change would become as huge as it has become?
Well, for me, the real transition in my thinking happened when I read in a couple of books intended for the general audience about an analog for our current release of greenhouse gases that happened quite a long time ago, but sufficiently close in scale and timing to be worth taking seriously as a past example.
Mm-hmm.
And the event had very serious consequences that lasted for millennia. The event in question happened about 55 million years ago, they reckon, and there was a great escape of carbon dioxide that happened a little bit more slowly than we're releasing it, but on a somewhat smaller scale, but close enough in overall dimensions. Now, this escape, it took 20,000 years, apparently, for the CO2 release to be recaptured by living organisms, and one of the results was several millions of years without polar sea ice. So the event was eventually corrected by the planet, but over such a long time period. And I think before we knew that there had been an event so similar to what we're casually causing right now, people couldn't get a proper frame on it. And I know I used to think that climate change was going to come, but probably not for a couple of hundred years and not on as big a scale.
How would you compare the amount of time it takes for masses of ice to melt with the amount of time it takes for masses of ice to reform?
It seems to be three or four orders of magnitude difference. Stuff can melt in less than 100 years and take tens of millennia to reform. And that's what's really disturbing. I think at the moment we're in a bit of confusion about what language to use about this. Global warming is the direct phenomenon caused by greenhouse gases rising in concentration, and that is perceived as something that will cause climate change. But the immediate worry seems to be more that global warming will cause global defrosting, as I've taken to calling it recently. Significant rises in sea levels and significant dryings up of glacier-fed rivers in most of the inhabited continents will lead the people in almost everywhere to be very seriously affected, either directly because they live near sea level or indirectly because they're going to be asked to help pay for solving the problems of those who live near sea level. So the event will cause great expense and suffering, even before you include the fact that climates are probably going to shift in many places and in partly unpredictably. The event is going to take several forms, but it's going to involve almost everybody, and an awful lot sooner than people had been thinking until just a few years ago.
Yeah, I was reading from your unpublished paper, so you're suggesting that the very next generation will confront, as you wrote, massive disruptions and expenses?
Yeah, it seems crazy not to take that prospect very seriously. And the scale of expenses and disruptions is such that if we don't prepare for it on a large scale, it will throw us into crisis.
And very briefly, I mean, you've referred to global defrosting, and you pointed out that the melting of ice will raise sea levels, which inundates cities and coastlines, and the world's glacier-fed rivers will disappear. And so, just very explicitly, what happens when those rivers disappear?
Well, large numbers of high concentrations of population in the world currently depend on glacier-fed rivers for a great deal of their water supply, and indeed, in many cases, for irrigation of agriculture. So it's not clear what their alternative water supply would be. Now, there's changes coming in precipitation patterns that we don't know in detail yet, but it doesn't seem very likely that those would compensate except by complete fluke.
So with this global defrosting that is coming in the near future as opposed to the far future, how do you get from there? And certainly inundating cities and entire nations is a calamitous, momentous event. But how do you get from there to saying that 20th century civilization, I mean, that's a very big term, a very broad term, an all-encompassing term. How do you get from there to saying that 20th century civilization will collapse because of this?
Well, it will, if we don't make large preparations, it will collapse because it currently relies on the massive transportation of basic commodities in very complex networks all over the planet. And people in, not absolutely everywhere, but people in most countries are significantly dependent on goods imported from far away. The arrangements by which that are done are all coastal. So all the infrastructure for organizing the global trade on which so many people now depend on would be an immediate victim of the rising sea levels. So there's an immediate crisis of a reinvestment in relocation of infrastructure. And that's a scale of expense that I don't think we really have any analog for in the past. I mean, even such a thing as the continuous Cold War didn't cost anything like the quantity of money that we'd be looking at for reorganizing the world's transportation systems that it's currently dependent on.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one kind of glaring example. I think the what we have to do then is to redesign our global civilization so it is not so dependent on such vulnerable arrangements. Now, that is hardly a smaller proposition than dealing with a crisis. Seems to me our choice is to head towards crisis or to undergo a massive reorganization.
Colin Duncan is his name. He teaches environmental history at two Canadian universities, Queen's University and McGill. He is author of The Centrality of Agriculture Between Humankind and the Rest of Nature. And he's currently writing a popular book about the best case response to global warming. The unpublished paper we're talking about today will, in some form or another, be incorporated into the book. The unpublished paper is entitled The Practical Equivalent of War or Using Rapid Massive Climate Change to Ease the Great Transition Towards New Sustainable Anthropocentrism. You have asserted, Colin, that 20th century civilization depended on three essential factors. Let's take them one by one. The first has to do with fossil fuels, correct?
Yeah, the heavy burning of fossil fuels is buried in the acts of daily life in many cultures to a very deep extent. There's very little that people do in North America that doesn't directly or indirectly require the burning of fossil fuels. In some cultures and some parts of the world, this is much less the case. But the arrangements of mass transportation I alluded to earlier that 20th century civilization depends on all currently require the burning of fossil fuels on a large scale. It's kind of like our blood these days.
What about the second one? That has to do with food.
Well, I think 20th century civilization as an economic arrangement has had its ups and downs in the vicissitudes of war, to just mention one factor. But overall, the patterns of increasing global trade seem to me to have depended on the price of food being relatively low compared to the price of other commodities in certainly all the wealthy countries. And this has been a factor allowing them to become so global in their reach. So cheap food has been a fundamental pillar of the 20th century civilization that the wealthy countries created and have recently been attempting to impose on the whole planet.
Okay, so we've got abundant liquid fossil fuel. We've got reliably cheap food. Those you see as two of the essential factors of 20th century civilization. What's the third?
The third, I think, in the case of the wealthy countries, has been a sustained high level of government spending since the late 1930s, which has enabled these economies in the wealthy countries based on the integrated price-setting markets, to enable them to forestall anything analogous to the Great Depression, that is a catastrophic fall in the prices of almost all commodities. So sustained government spending has kept deep recession away from the wealthy countries for something like 60 years now. 70 years, I should say. And this has mostly taken the form of very substantial military spending. And that's been acutely the case in a number of the most powerful wealthy countries. So there's been a reliance on government spending to keep the economy from plunging into general price falls.
So military spending that goes to contractors who employ people and keep the economy humming in the view of some people.
Yeah. I mean, in the United States, for example, every state is to some extent involved in production facilities for for military equipment, directly or indirectly. So it's become a substantial chunk, permanent chunk of the economy.
And I think when we look at the first factor, the abundant liquid fossil fuel, we know, it's very clear to us how that factor has contributed and led to climate change, to what you're calling global defrosting. What about the other two factors? How do we link them up? And I think you've already begun to make this clear, but how do we link this up with climate change?
I guess in a way, the second factor, the abundant cheap food for the people of the wealthy countries, that becomes an open question with unfolding climate change. And so it may no longer be the case that the wealthy countries could rely on that cheap food. On the other hand, and this is perhaps the positive side, since there has been a long now tradition of large government spending, which has supported those economies, if we could just envisage switching that spending to preparing for dealing with climate change, it's not as though there's a sudden fiscal crisis we would face. We just have to stop building weapons and start building whatever is required to reorganize the economy so that we can first halt climate change from getting worse and prepare for the consequences of the changes we've already set in motion.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. The associate producer is H.N. Yuen. My name is C.S. Song, and joining us by phone from Kingston, Ontario, Canada, is Colin Duncan. He is an environmental historian. He has a Ph.D. in political economy from York University in Toronto. He formerly worked in the microbiology department at the University of Edinburgh, working with the, as I understand it, the DNA of ancient bacteria. And we're talking about a paper he's written and presented that he hopes to turn into a book about global warming and about how humans can and should respond to the threat of imminent, vast, and rapid climate change. You've asserted, or you do assert in this paper, that everything we needed to know to justify serious action on climate change, we have known for 40 years. And you find that alarming, and certainly so do I. What have we known such that we could have gotten on this horse and maybe taken serious steps to avert climate change many decades ago?
Well, I think the two facts that you need to be aware of to understand that climate change can be fairly rapid is you need to know about the capacity of greenhouse gases to cause an increase in global average temperatures. That idea was actually suggested 100 years ago by the Swedish scientist Arrhenius. Until we knew about plate tectonics and that there is sometimes a large quantity of ice on the planet for very long periods of time, and sometimes there's not. Until we knew about plate tectonics, we couldn't really understand that our evolution occurred in a period that happened to have a lot of ice. Our species, in a sense, is used to the colder version of our planet. But plate tectonics only results in permanent large quantities of ice on the planet by fluke and occasionally, but that's over very, very long time periods. As I understand it, the plate tectonics was really figured out in the 1960s. And we could then, as I say, about 40 years ago, have realized that we evolved in a cold planet and we could carelessly warm it. That is, we could have figured out 40 years ago that there's something fundamentally fragile about our situation. And if there were still only a couple of million humans, it probably wouldn't have mattered at all. But looking at heading towards 10 billion people, it's extremely dangerous to rewarm the planet, and certainly sad to do that for reasons as trivial as many of the examples of burning of fossil fuels are.
Well, speaking of trivial and banal, you also write that carbon dioxide, I mean, this is stuff we exhale. Who could have thought that something as banal as carbon dioxide could create such a crisis so quickly?
Yeah, I think we had actually a little bit of trouble with the concept of pollution in this regard. Pollution has got negative connotations, obviously, by definition. But things can harm us because of their concentration, even if they are otherwise quite benign. And it's, I think, quite a surprise for people to realize that a normal chemical, something in every breath every mammal has ever exhaled, a normal chemical can have a large negative effect. And carbon dioxide is also present in the Earth's atmosphere at very, very low, it's a very low percentage of the composition of the Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
That something so small and so normal could cause a huge event is something that I don't think we could understand. It's as though we didn't have a category for large events having tiny causes.
What impact, because part of this unpublished article, I mean, you refer in the title of this article to a new sustainable anthropocentrism, and I wonder what impact anthropocentrism, which is the placing of humans at the center of all things, at the center of analysis, what impact that has had on science and on science's ability to examine the impact of human activity on the broader world?
Well, I think in the last several millennia, since the development of agricultures and large complex societies, there has been a quite general assumption that the planet is for human use. And certainly there were not cultural precepts preventing that kind of thinking in the kinds of complex societies I'm talking about. So there was a lack of barrier to continuing to modify the planet. I mean, agriculture was itself a major rearrangement of large parts of the Earth's surface, but it helped fuel a more general willingness to change the world for even short-term human purposes. And that really is what anthropocentrism is. Now, in the crisis we're in, we're obviously going to have to be dealing with this crisis in order to, as it were, save ourselves or save future generations and prevent needless misery. So we're going to be putting ourselves first, but in a different way this time. So that's why I would say we've been in unsustainable anthropocentrism, and we have to switch to sustainable anthropocentrism.
I'm CS. He is Colin Duncan. He joins us by phone from Kingston, Ontario, Canada. And we have a link on againstofthegrain.org to his book, The Centrality of Agriculture, Between Humankind and the Rest of Nature. We are talking today about some thoughts, many thoughts he's had, that will go into a book he's writing about the best-case response to global warming. If we can talk a little bit more about 20th century civilization, which you still see as extant today, and what it's done such that climate change has become such a big crisis. You know, there's been some a lot of talk about the deregulation of almost everything, but including capital. Capital has been moving around the world. It has been those capital flows, those international capital flows, have been deregulated in the latter part of the 20th century. What has this done? What should we know about the impact of this on the climate and on people?
Well, there's a very long story of the last several decades economic history. I guess high points in the story from this point of view would be that the lifting of restrictions on the export of capital that became quite general in wealthy countries around 1980 did lead to a significant shift of industrial infrastructure from the wealthy countries to the so-called emerging economies, of which China and India are the most notable current examples. They were put to becoming the new workshops of the enormous and growing quantity of global trade, including in very basic commodities. I mean, global trade goes back millennia, but a lot of it was in luxuries several millennia ago. Now, the extent of global trade in basics has been, to no small extent, a function of the mass export of capital from the wealthy countries in the last 25 years. And I think to deal with the upcoming problem, mm-hmm. we need to, if we're going to make a positive solution rather than just wait for a crisis, if we want to make a positive solution, we will have to remove some of the freedom of movement of capital, because some of it will have to be redirected. Some huge capital projects will, it seems, just have to be stopped, and the capital from those redirected to the extent possible to some of the preparations we need to make for dealing with the consequences of what we've already caused. So an example of a negative shutting down of some capital activities would be we must reduce the investment in extracting and refining fossil fuels, since they're contributing so strongly to the problem. And we must simultaneously invest in whatever replacement technologies will be required. So we have to take capital from many current projects and put it into new ones. And this seems to require quite a lot of restrictions on what has been an unusually free period for capital in the last quarter century.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. At the controls is Jen Angel. The associate producer is H.N. Ewan. My name is C.S. Song. And we're talking about with Colin Duncan, an environmental historian who teaches at Queen's University and McGill University in Canada, about his thoughts, which have been presented and have been written about in an unpublished paper that looks at what he sees as the imminent, fast, and vast climate change that will happen, and the resulting collapse of 20th century civilization as he sees it, and what people can do now to plan for a transition to a totally different kind, a totally sustainable, a much more sustainable and earth-friendly system and society and polity. Colin, how likely is it that the people with the most wealth and power today, that they will plan for this upcoming collapse?
How likely? I refuse to be committed to a prediction on that score. I would rather put it in the form of describing the alternatives that these people, and I must include myself, face. The alternatives are to make substantial preparations and design a better replacement system, or to head for a period of severe crisis and very likely escalating violent clashes all over the planet. So I think another alternative is in itself attractive, but one is clearly more attractive than the other. And I don't think that there is a third choice. As I see it at the moment, we are casually drifting towards the worse alternative.
What kind
of... So a major change of approach is required soon.
And what kind of common collective effort will it take to do this kind of planning to achieve this kind of transition?
Well, the only analogous type of event in human affairs that I can think of that could give us any grounds for optimism that we could actually respond on an adequate scale to do the best we could. The only analog really is the commitment inside warring societies to the total war. During World War II, most of the combatant nations massively reorganized their economies for the purpose. That was for the negative purpose of fighting each other, but they did completely reorganize their economies. This was acutely the case in Britain, the former Soviet Union, and to a great extent the United States and Japan as well. In the course of this redirection of the economy for a temporary common purpose, there was a lot of positive feedback. There was a great reduction in inequality, and there was an extraordinary amount of positive participation evinced in the populations in all these countries, even though they were doing it in the context of warfare. So what I think we could do is envisage something like an equivalent scale of declaration, but this time there's no enemy, but we must think in terms of working together to do an enormous response, and that would be the best we could do. And the war examples have that positive kernel of positive feedback.
The American pragmatist philosopher William James wrote an essay that I think appeared in 1910. It's entitled "The Moral Equivalent of War." What did he argue therein, and what do you think we could take from it?
Well, James's essay was a very interesting piece. James wrote it, as you said, I believe it was published in 1910. He wrote it in the context of the militarist competition between the wealthy countries that was causing and eventually eventuated in World War I. So in 1910, James, like many others, could see a major international conflict coming. He regretted this. One thing he noticed was that a lot of people were looking forward to major conflict. There was a kind of crass social Darwinist idea that conflict was in itself beneficial. And toughening societies had to do with the overemphasis on competition in the understanding of Darwin's insights at the time. And James said, well, let's just accept this argument that society needs to undergo major common projects, but instead of all us wealthy nations drifting towards massive war, why don't we instead plan a joint, what he called, conquest of nature? He meant by that massive common investment in infrastructure for making the planet more suitable for human beings. Now, we as environmentalists might question that language of the conquest of nature as the right way to describe the project. But what James was suggesting that was that you could have something that would be morally equivalent to negative warfare in a collective attack on our common problems. And he at the time thought it would be the application of science and labor to making life easier. I'm sort of suggesting turning the idea inside out, saying, actually, our great success since James wrote in making life easier has actually caused our looming problem of climate change. What we need now is to embark on a similar kind of mass collective effort, but this time to reconfigure the economy so that it is beneficial to humans but does not create this massive problem of climate change that we've already started to unleash.
And what kinds of processes are you suggesting? You began talking about some of them before the break. If we, in fact, need to replace the fossil fuel-intensive processes that produce and deliver what we need with processes that don't generate CO2, what kinds of methods and mechanisms should we be looking toward?
Well, in the case of the wealthy countries, there will obviously have to be some substantial reduction of consumption of goods. But there's obviously lots of scope for that in the wealthy countries. In less wealthy countries, there is not. Now, the reduction of consumption in the wealthy countries is the easiest part of the problem, technically. The question that I hope is answerable in positive terms is that we can produce enough food and fuel and fiber using biotic processes rather than relying on fossil fuels and the metals we cannot use without fossil fuels. So the big technical question is, can the world's agricultures, under conditions of climate change, be reconfigured to take over the supplying of many things that we get from and move about with fossil fuels? So the onus will be on the world's agricultures to pick up a lot of the slack if we reduce fossil fuel combustion to the levels we need to.
And what can we learn from agricultures in the past that have both been very productive and light on carbon-based fuels?
Well, I believe, and I hope this can be demonstrated more closely to be the case, that past agricultures that relied heavily on humus in the soil, on keeping a high level of organic material in the soil, that those agricultures can be revived and tweaked. At the moment, our industrial agricultures rather ignore what humus can do to help us, and indeed have tended to supplant humus's role in the in plant metabolism. It's an indirect role, but it used to be a significant role. So if we can get more organic agricultures, as they're often called, to replace our industrialized agricultures, then apparently there is a possibility of sequestering quite a lot of carbon in the soil and getting local agricultures to supply a very large fraction, again, of what we absolutely need. And to the extent that local agricultures can do this for local populations, then we can reduce the total quantity of transportation of material and goods that at the moment is one of the extra causes of the high levels of burning of fossil fuels.
Yeah, you're really focused, among other things, on this question of how much energy it takes to transport food and supplies from one place to another.
Yeah, I mean it's a very significant fraction of our total fossil fuel combustion. It's by no means the only large fraction, but it is one that we didn't used to depend on so much, and I would think it's one of the first things to look at to reduce. And in addition to the absurdly high levels of consumption in so characteristic of the wealthy countries.
Let's go back to some of these agricultural practices you find interesting, specifically among English, European, and Asian practices and methods. What kinds of things would you like to see us bring back?
Well, I think the farming systems until about a century ago, in most countries with highly productive agricultures, did mostly rely on the on-farm recycling of inputs. That is, there were relatively few off-farm inputs. And, you know, the exact carbon gas chemistry involved in the different agricultures, I don't think it's yet understood closely enough, but it seems that if we cannot get those sorts of agricultures to be revived and tweaked, and we certainly know a lot more ecology to be able to tweak them better soon, if we can't get those to play a role in compensating us, as it were, for reducing our heavy reliance on fossil fuels, then we are going to be painted into a corner. So I look at agriculture as our best great hope. I mean, other people are waiting for fusion technology or hoping that we could build enough nuclear reactors in a big hurry. I think those are certainly no less fantastic than the suggestion I make. One of the advantages of getting agricultures to play this role of being basic suppliers of food, fuel, and fiber without such heavy use of industrial inputs, one of the side benefits of this is that it would, I think, issue in a kind of New Deal for the world's peasantry, which sounds like a rather grand hope. But if agricultures were fundamental again, in basic economic patterns, then presumably those people who work in it could expect to be better rewarded. In the last 125 years, peasantries the world over have had to be subsidized in all sorts of different ways. And even farmers in the wealthy countries have had to be subsidized because of the very volatile and frequently disruptive patterns of world trade and basic agricultural commodities. So if agriculture is made to play a more basic role again, that's obvious, then perhaps we could turn life around for rural people. I know at the moment in China, there's quite a critical balancing act because the Chinese government is obviously very keen on its industrial role in the world economy. But China does need a lot from its own peasantry. But a lot of the Chinese peasantry at the moment feels exploited under these circumstances. So there's a great tension there. And similar tensions apply in countries in many parts of the world.
Indeed. I'm CS. He is Colin Duncan. He joins us by phone from Kingston, Ontario. And he is an environmental historian. He also teaches modern British history at Queen's University and McGill University. We have a link to his book on againstthegrain.org, where you can also go to download podcasts of our programs. And just to flesh that out, the question of agricultural practices out a little bit, I just wanted to mention that Colin's paper refers to terraced wet rice cultivation still practiced in warm and wet parts of Asia. He also looks at systems for raising wheat and sheep simultaneously that were developed in temperate England. He talks about European techniques for tree management, other kinds of practices that he thinks might be or should be continued or brought back, and that would lead to a more sustainable future. I want to ask you, since fossil fuels cast their shadow over everything we're talking about, I wanted to ask you about something in your country that a lot of people are looking to either solve some of the world's energy needs or at least make a dent in them, which is the tar sands extraction project in Alberta. Tell us briefly about this project and what you think it says about the scarcity or abundance of oil.
Well, the project has become very big in the last decade. It's been a latent possibility for a long time. There's a great deal of oily material and sand mixed together that requires a great deal of energy to separate. And so long as the price of oil was quite low, it did not make any price sense. Now, since the price of oil has climbed quite a bit in the last decade or so, there has been massive investment in very expensive apparatus for extracting a kind of fairly clean crude oil from these tar sands. It's only barely positive from an energy point of view.
What does that mean?
Very expensive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's been a great deal of questioning of it. It at the moment requires the release of a great deal of greenhouse gases just to make this oil accessible. And it seems like a very negative contribution to the current situation. On the other hand, there has been such massive investment in it that it is something that a large chunk of the current Canadian economy actually depends on. I can't for the life of me think of a way of shutting the tar sands down that would not require a significant government commitment to some kind of compensation and redirection of the capital involved. I don't think we can expect the investors in the tar sands to spontaneously walk away from the project. It wasn't clearly their idea to cause climate change, but they're considerable contributors to it. It was thinking about that kind of case that made me think that we have to think in terms of something like the commitment of the economy to a new path that was done during large scale wars, because it's very big and it has to be changed.
And the question,
we're not used to dealing with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Ahead of time.
Well, there's also the question of the inclination of governments and states to actually do some of the things you're proposing. And given the economic system that we have today, how do you see states coming around to the fact that, hey, we need to listen to Colin Duncan, we need to start developing and implementing some of these agricultural and other earth-friendly practices he's talking about?
Well, I think to a great extent, the economic policies of the last quarter century, which have been directed by the new sort of neoliberal or neoconservative consensus, encouraged a lot of the investments that are currently exacerbating our problem. These ideas have, I think, run their useful course, and in order to reverse the free market emphasis of the last 25 years, we would need to consider, I think, coalition governments in the wealthy countries to start the ball rolling in a different direction. I don't think we can expect a spontaneous response on an adequate scale. But if coalition governments were put in place, they could have the best chance of persuading those who stand to lose in the short term. They would stand the best chance of persuading them to accept the required rearrangements.
Coalition governments, by that you mean what, different political parties sharing power?
Yeah. Yeah, a government which you would have to have at least some major cabinet-type posts for representatives of every part of the political spectrum. That can bring very positive results.
We just have a couple minutes left. You referred to the destruction of much of the vital infrastructure on which 20th century civilization depends, with, say, rising sea levels. If a new infrastructure must eventually be built that will require less fossil fuels, don't we face the dilemma that the construction of that new infrastructure will, in fact, require tremendous amounts of energy?
Yes, that's one of the nastiest technical problems. There's a need to do a lot of big projects in order to stop doing so many big projects. And that is a conundrum that I hope we can solve. It'll take a great deal of ingenuity, but there's no shortage of that. But what at the moment seems to be missing is a will to really explore the possibilities of using that ingenuity on a scale sufficient to turn the problem around. And that's the great hurdle at the moment, is getting us to take it seriously enough on a large enough scale and soon enough.
Colin Duncan teaches environmental history and modern British history at Queen's University and McGill University in Canada. Thanks so much, Colin, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song with associate producer H.N. Yuen. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find program information and archived audio. You can contact us by emailing againstthegrain@kpfa.org or by calling 510-848-6767, extension 670. And thanks to Jen Angel, who was at the controls today.